Hundreds of protesters have gathered outside the offices of the United Nations in Bangkok Sunday, demanding action on restoring peace in Myanmar. Most demonstrators were Myanmar citizens living in Thailand. The two countries share a border, and Thailand is home to a very large number of Myanmar nationals. February 1st, the military ousted Aung San Suu Kyi's elected government and declared a year-long state of emergency. Since then, demonstrations have been held across various cities. Military-led actions to crush protests have led to bloodshed in which dozens of citizens have been killed. Pope Francis celebrated Mass Sunday with several thousand worshipers spread across a stadium in the Kurdistan regional capital, the largest liturgy of his trip to the pandemic-hit Iraq. Amid fears the Mass could become a super-spreader event, authorities restricted attendance at the stadium, which usually holds 20,000 people. Saturday, the pontiff met with the country's top Shiite cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, delivering a powerful message of peaceful coexistence. A Saudi-led military coalition mounted airstrikes on Yemen's Houthi-controlled capital Sana'a Sunday after it intercepted 10 drones launched by the Iran-backed rebels, state media reported. The strikes triggered huge explosions in Sana'a and sent plumes of smoke rising in the sky, according to an AFP correspondent and photographer at the scene. The rebels reported 7 airstrikes on the capital. The raids come after a sharp escalation in cross-border attacks on the kingdom. The coalition said the drones were aimed at civilian targets in Saudi Arabia, SPA reported, without specifying the locations. This is VOA News. The UK government called for the immediate release of a British-Iranian woman Sunday after her 5-year sentence for sedition ended in Tehran. Her local MP in London said she has had her ankle tag removed. The 42-year-old dual national has been under house arrest for months. She now faces another court date in Iran next Sunday, dashing hopes from her family, friends, and colleagues of an immediate return home. British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab called her treatment by the authorities in the Islamic Republic, quote, intolerable. The European Union should shake off its ill will and build a good relationship with Britain as sovereign equals, Britain's top EU advisor said Sunday, promising to stand up for the country's interests. Writing in the Sunday Telegraph, David Frost again defended Britain's unilateral move to smooth post-Brexit trade between Britain and Northern Ireland, over which the EU has promised to launch legal action for breaching terms of the Brexit deal. Since Britain left the EU last year, relations between the two have soured, with both sides accusing the other of acting in bad faith and retaliation in bad faith in relation to part of their trade agreement that covers goods movements to Northern Ireland. A crowd of up to 800,000 turned out for a state election rally Sunday by Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi as he sought to unseat one of his fiercest critics in a campaign hit by violence. Modi's Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party has been seeking to expand its power at the state level. He's eyeing the eastern state of West Bengal, a state that has so far eluded the BJP. Staggered polling kicks off March 27th. A far-right proposal to ban facial coverings in Switzerland headed towards a narrow victory in a binding referendum Sunday, instigated by the same group that organized a 2009 ban on new minarets. Projections for broadcast SRF based on partial results showed the vote to amend the Swiss constitution passing 52% to 48% with a 2-point margin of error. Final results are due later Sunday. Support for German Chancellor Angela Merkel's conservative bloc hit a 1-year low Sunday, a key survey showed, hammered by growing anger over a sluggish vaccine rollout and a mask procurement scandal. Merkel's CDU-CSU bloc fell to 32% in a survey by the Kantar Institute for Bild newspaper, a 2% drop from last week. Thousands of people across France flooded to vaccination centers Sunday as the government stepped up inoculations against the coronavirus to ease the load on hospitals and stave off further restrictions. By remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. U.S. lawmakers conducted hearings investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol by pro-Trump rioters trying to overturn Joe Biden's election victory. Federal Bureau of Investigations Director Christopher Wray told lawmakers that the attack was in fact domestic terrorism, while some Republican senators continued to push theories about the riots being led by groups opposed to Trump. The United States imposed sanctions to punish Russia for what it describes as Moscow's attempt to poison opposition leader Alexei Navalny with a nerve agent last year. The sanctions against seven senior Russian officials, among them the head of its FSB security service and on 14 entities, marks a sharp departure from former President Donald Trump's reluctance to confront Russian President Vladimir Putin. At least 10 rockets targeted a military base in western Iraq that hosts U.S.-led coalition troops. One American died as a result of the attack. Texas became the biggest U.S. state to lift its mask rule, joining a number of government leaders that loosened COVID-19 restrictions. This despite pleas from health officials not to let their guard down yet. And domestic turmoil rocked several nations, with violent protests continuing in Myanmar, Ethiopia continuing a fierce crackdown in its Tigray region, and China conducting a mass arrest of democracy advocates in Hong Kong. We take a look at these flashpoints and discuss how the Biden administration might respond. Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining the panel today. We're going to start off with the Capitol riot hearings as they continued this week with a steady stream of top officials in law enforcement and the military trying to piece together the events before, during, and after the violent insurrection at the Capitol that left five dead. FBI Director Wray told lawmakers that the Bureau did in fact have raw intelligence warning of violence, and lawmakers are now trying to find out what was known, why the intelligence didn't lead to a more prepared force at the Capitol, and what caused the delayed response on the day of the insurrection. I'll go to you first, JJ. What are the officials saying about the intelligence? And can you help us understand this phrase raw intelligence and why it differs from any other type of intelligence and how that might affect the response of law enforcement officials and the military?
Hey, Michael, thank you for doing this, and thanks for the question. I'll start with your second question first. Raw intelligence is basically information, whether it's chatter, whether it's verbal information that's collected or online post or anything that is just taken in its raw form. It's not synthesized. It's not analyzed. It's not essentially vetted. This is just the raw data. And that is something that authorities pointed out very clearly during these hearings that they were getting a lot of in the run-up to January 6th. And that information not being vetted, not being essentially analyzed before it's disseminated, is suspect. So this is a part of what their concern was in being prepared for the 6th of January. They were getting tons of information for weeks and sometimes months before that. But a lot of that information, just the sheer volume of it because of the internet today, just made it really impossible for them to figure out what all of it meant. In terms of what went down on the 6th, according to Chris Wray and Jill Sanborn, both from the FBI, is that they had three different ways of disseminating the intelligence that they disseminated. One was a verbal briefing for all of the key players. Another thing was an email that was sent out to all the stakeholders. And the third thing was there was an online portal through which all of the information could have been viewed and essentially evaluated by the Capitol Police and all of the stakeholders responsible for security on the Hill. So there was some pushback to this idea that the FBI did not provide intelligence. Chris Wray said it was there. The question of whether or why it didn't get to the key stakeholders, he said, I don't have an answer for that.
And Josh, we've talked about Chris Wray, we've talked about Jill Sanborn, the FBI officials who testified. Who were some of the more compelling people who testified this week, and what stood out in your mind as compelling and significant testimony pointing to what happened before, during, and after?
You know, while everyone who saw what happened on January 6th with the invasion of the Capitol realizes that this is a very severe problem, and this isn't a problem that's just going to go away, only this week there's another threat to Capitol Hill, and lawmakers have moved a vote because they had information from intelligence services that there was another QAnon-linked conspiracy plot and threat to Capitol Hill. So no one's pretending this isn't a very grave issue facing America. But I do think there's a real danger in treating Americans like you would treat Al-Qaeda or ISIS, which is what's being advocated by some on the left right now. And, you know, there's a danger that that deepens divisions in American society and creates larger fissures rather than trying to unify and heal America, which is obviously a difficult task, but that is the message that Joe Biden came into office with and that he has sought to promote, at least with his rhetoric.
It would seem that to get to the truth would be a large part of the healing. That would be the healing salve that you could put on the wounds. And we'll talk a little bit more about getting to the truth and how we actually do that. But JJ, I want to throw to you the testimony that has so far led to some questions about a couple of officials, namely former acting Secretary of Defense Christopher Miller, who was under the Trump administration, and the current Deputy Chief of Staff of the Army, Lieutenant General Charles Flynn, who happens to be the brother of General Mike Flynn, who formerly was in the Obama administration, the Trump administration, and now is sort of a major QAnon believer and figurehead. These people seem to have a very prominent role in what the response was on the day of the insurrection, and specifically the delay that happened between when help was asked for and when help arrived. What do we know about that? And should these people be testifying themselves?
Michael, I'm not sure they won't be testifying, because what you just raised is a very significant question that a lot of people have been thinking about and have been talking about. And some of these names that you've been mentioning, Miller and Flynn, are coming up. There are other names like Wolf, other names like Patel, who've come up as well. And I can tell you from talking to several intelligence and law enforcement officials who are still in place, some people, they say, that were in government on January 6th were deep down the rabbit hole of QAnon conspiracies. And they, in the words of these people that I've been speaking to, are people that are going to have some conversations with some people, going to answer some serious questions. Not saying that any of them did anything wrong or illegal, I should say, but I do know this. There are a lot of people on Capitol Hill, a lot of people in the intelligence and law enforcement communities that want to talk to these folks about what was going on in their minds and their heads on this day, specifically those folks that had responsibility for security and could have made calls to, in fact, maybe have brought this situation on Capitol Hill on January 6th under control hours before it did.
So you have the prospect of these groups out there, these sort of amorphous groups that are being brought together either online or in groups somehow, militia groups, this whole sort of universe of people that feels a certain type of aggression towards the government for one reason or another. And Christopher Wray testified about them months ago. And then you have the possibility of that element within the government. And now you have Republican senators like Ron Johnson of Wisconsin saying that the riots were not run by pro-Trump supporters, and that he even characterized them and read into the record an account that described the day as having a festival atmosphere. How do we get to the truth if we have this turning into such a partisan process where we can't even agree on something that everybody's eyes clearly saw?
What we're seeing from some more pro-Trump Republicans is what you might call whataboutism, where they're seeking not to deny the gravity of what happened, but to muddy the waters and to point out that, yes, maybe there were a couple of people there whose ideologies are so addled that they're both Antifa and pro-Trump or neither. They may have just been anarchists, but pretty clear to anyone who was there, as I was, or who has reported on it, and frankly, who watched it, that this was a pro-Trump protest turned riot. But the hope is that if you can kind of give people enough different pieces of information, if you can stir the pot and muddy the waters to a certain degree, then it just becomes a little bit confusing. You know, JJ's right that the key point here is, or one of the absolute key points, is that 2 to 3 hour gap when really nothing much was done, despite the astonishing images we saw on our TV screens and the astonishing things that were happening in the halls of Congress. And the likelihood is, and this is what this whole thing is pointing at, is that that delay came from the very top. The likelihood is, from the reporting we've seen, that President Trump didn't necessarily want to end what was happening on Capitol Hill, at least not immediately. Now, that is obviously a shocking thing, and it's something we probably want to try and get to the bottom of, but may never do, because, as you point out, there's a lot of partisan politics at play here. There's not a lot of incentive for Republicans to support a very clear and far-reaching investigation. But we already do know a lot. And frankly, in some ways, it's pretty obvious that help was withheld because it didn't arrive for 3 hours. And when it did arrive, that put an end to the matter. You know, we saw National Guard coming in from Maryland and Virginia, and that was the end of the matter. So in some ways, we saw with our own eyes what happened that day.
Certainly did. And I'm going to finish with you, JJ, on this subject. I know that you don't go into the politics on these things when we talk about them, but I will talk about having the truth affect security. How can we keep the nation secure? How can we keep Congress and lawmakers secure when we can't agree on what a threat actually is?
Well, the reality of this, Michael, and that's a great question, but the reality is the people that are charged with protecting and keeping the nation safe, they don't listen to the politicians. They don't answer to the politicians. They answer to essentially their oath of office to protect the nation against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And they have the right, and some on rare occasions have exercised it in the past, to disobey orders that aren't legal, that would put the nation in harm's way. The people who are behind the scenes that actually are responsible for making sure that the U.S. is safe know what they're doing, and they know that they can make the right decisions regardless of what the politics say. There has been some leakage into the process in the last few years. In fact, one particular source that I spoke to said very clearly to me that there were those who wanted to minimize what Congress and what the American people knew about Russia's meddling in the U.S. and anything negative about Russia. They wanted to tamp it down. They also wanted to tamp down anything that had to do with, quote, white supremacists. These are people in the law enforcement and in the intelligence sector, but they were few and far between. The lion's share of people in these communities know that they have a responsibility to keep America safe because America is their home. It's their street. It's their block. It's not just some big country they live in. It's everything and everyone that's in it.
It remains a challenge both to find the truth and to execute safely and democratically these processes that keep us all safe and free. Oh, we will be watching. Let's take a break, and we'll be back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. JJ Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. And our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Let's move on to the Navalny sanctions and talk a little bit about Jamal Khashoggi as well. This from a New York Times report. The Biden administration classified an intelligence finding that the FSB, one of Russia's leading intelligence agencies, orchestrated the poisoning of the opposition leader Alexei Navalny and announced its first sanctions against the Russian government for the attack and his imprisonment. The sanctions closely mirrored a series of actions that European nations and Britain took in October and expanded on Monday. Senior officials said the move was part of an effort to show unity in the Biden administration's first confrontations with the government of President Vladimir Putin of Russia. But none of the other sanctions were specifically directed at Mr. Putin or the oligarchs who support the Russian military. Josh, I'll start with you. An indication this is, I believe, of the new stance on Russia by the Biden administration, and indeed an orchestrated and unified stance against Russia.
Yeah, I think it's important to acknowledge the Trump administration was in some ways quite tough on Russia. They imposed sanctions on some of Russia's richest individuals. They approved lethal weapon sales to Ukraine. They fought hard against the Nord Stream 2 oil pipeline, a gas pipeline between Germany and Russia. The rhetoric from the Trump administration, particularly from the top, was a little softer. Trump had a kind of personal rapport or sort of personal rapport with President Putin, but their actual policy was reasonably tough. And in some ways, we're seeing a continuity of that from the Biden administration, who don't have a lot of affection for Russia. And so they are seeking to continue a tough stance on Russia. This stance will include tough rhetoric. It will include rhetoric about human rights, which the Trump administration did not talk about really with regards to Russia. With the imprisonment of Alexei Navalny, an opposition leader in Russia, the Biden administration is seeking to respond specifically to that with added sanctions. So they're putting their might behind a human rights issue And they are also, you know, pushing back against the Nord Stream 2 pipeline as well, although there is some concern that they're not pushing back hard enough. If you talk to some Eastern European countries, places like Estonia, who are very concerned about this pipeline and this connection between Germany and Russia, they feel the Americans could be doing more on Nord Stream. But they are pushing back and they are seeking to use sanctions to hurt the Russians in their pocketbooks.
And I'll go to you, JJ, with kind of the same question. We have sanctions here. And are these sanctions significant enough or strong enough to be a deterrent to the type of Russian action, this type of poisoning?
I think what we're seeing is strong enough, in part because a couple of the people that I've spoken to say something a little different from what Josh just mentioned about the Trump approach. While what we saw from Trump was not weak, but some of them say they weren't as strong as they could have been. One of the things that's very interesting is the FBI added Yevgeny Prigozhin, who is known as Putin's chef, to its most wanted list. As you may remember, he was indicted in 2018 for his role in the election meddling situation in 2016. You know, he is the person who essentially ran or runs the Internet Research Agency, which is responsible for a lot of the mayhem that took place. But he was just added to the most wanted list. And when you ask the FBI about that, they don't say anything about it. But what you hear is that, okay, this is a message to the Putin administration that we're going to put some teeth behind what we've said and done in the past. As far as Navalny goes, there's a writer by the name of Brett Bruen. Actually, he is the former global engagement director for the Obama administration White House. And he wrote a piece in the Business Insider a couple of weeks ago. And in that piece, he said there's a very real possibility that the Biden administration cannot restore America's reputation by seeming to be or trying to be tougher. And a part of the reason for that, he said, is because the world has moved on. During the Trump administration, the world doesn't believe that it can trust the U.S. So it may be an objective of the Biden administration to restore that reputation, but they may not be able to do it, especially in some of these situations where Russia and China and some of these other places that the U.S. and the world has problems with are continuing to do what they do.
Josh, I'll give you the last word on this subject. The Biden administration imposed sanctions on Russia. In the case of Saudi Arabia and Mohammed bin Salman, was deemed responsible for Khashoggi's death. According to declassified intelligence, there were no sanctions. What's the difference?
The difference is that Saudi Arabia is an ally of America and Russia is an adversary. And I think the Biden administration, although it wants to recalibrate relations with Saudi Arabia and has frozen some weapon sales, released this report that is clearly marks Mohammed bin Salman as being responsible for the death of Jamal Khashoggi. They weren't willing to impose sanctions on MBS himself. They have sanctioned some Saudis in relation to the information that was released, and they are banning certain Saudis from entering America, something called the Khashoggi ban that they've created. But they pulled back from sanctioning bin Salman because Saudi is an ally. They are an important energy provider. They're an important counterbalance to Iran in the region. And they're important in America's counterterrorism work in the Middle East. And so alienating its primary subject, Mohammed bin Salman, was thought to be a step too far by the Biden administration. And many liberals, in fact, are disappointed with them. They felt that they wanted them to go further to really make an example of MBS and his extrajudicial killing of Khashoggi, a sort of really unpleasant incident that happened back in 2018.
We will see what further responses look like down the road. Just very quickly, I wanted to get to you, JJ, and ask you a question about the Iraqi attack on a U.S. base where there's 10 rockets were targeted. Second attack on the U.S. forces in Iraq in a calendar month. The previous attack coming in northern Iraq, I believe, in February. Just very quickly, has anyone claimed responsibility? And do we know what the U.S. response would look like?
No, nobody's claimed responsibility for it because Iran is not going to do that. And they don't ever claim responsibility for these situations, even though they are not pulling the trigger. They're paying the people that pull the trigger in situations like this. I have a very good source at Al-Assad and had that source there for a long time. And I've been there myself, too. It is a sprawling, gigantic base. So these kinds of attacks happen all the time. And it's not just Iran that's engaged in these attacks. There are ISIS forces there. There are other smaller militia groups that are there. But these particular ones are believed to have come from Iran, but it's not likely we'll hear them claim responsibility for it.
I want to move on to the COVID-19 update. We have great news again about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine being approved in the U.S., which requires only one shot instead of the two shots needed for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. President Biden saying that production is ahead of schedule, and we might even be on course for a semi-normal summer this year. So, Josh, I want to talk about the politics versus the science of loosening these restrictions. How are politicians making the balance to do this when you have officials saying, please don't loosen these restrictions, but at the same time, they're making the decision to go ahead with it and using things like invoking freedom and personal choice as the justification for opening up their states and cities?
As a politician, this whole pandemic has been a process of balancing science and politics and balancing also the desire for economic freedoms and the cost of keeping things shut down, keeping bars and restaurants shut down for months and months at a time, and the loss of people's livelihoods. It isn't just a case of everyone go out and have a party. These businesses need to survive. So there are tough calls to be made. Having said that, it does seem like some governors, Greg Abbott of Texas, for example, are moving quite precipitously towards reopening and ending mask mandates. It may be a little soon. We've seen cases plummet in America in the last month, very reassuringly, but they have plateaued of late at a reasonably high level, about 60,000 cases a day. We are going into a warmer period, particularly down south in places like Texas. So it's a concern. You know, the vaccination effort is ramping up as we speak. We're seeing 1.5 million a day be vaccinated. These are good numbers, but there's still a huge amount of vaccine still to be put into people's arms. And it would be a shame to see what would amount to a fourth surge in the virus just as the vaccine is coming into play and we're rounding the final stretch, if you like. And that's the concern that the health officials have.
We just have a couple of minutes left, but I'd like to get a quick comment from each one of you, because you have such a broad knowledge of the global stage, about this unrest that is happening among authoritarian regimes around the world. You have police in Myanmar repeatedly using tear gas, rubber bullets against crowds. These violent protests are continuing there. You have a marathon bail hearing after the Chinese government rounded up hundreds of Hong Kong democracy activists. Again, another crackdown on dissent from Beijing. And you have U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken pressing the leader of Ethiopia to end hostilities in its Tigray region in the north, citing a growing number of credible reports of atrocities and human rights violations and abuses. I'm going to start with you, Josh. The U.S. retreated from the stage a bit during the Trump administration. Is the U.S. still going to be an effective player in stemming this surge of authoritarianism and reasserting democracy and peace around the world?
You know, it's difficult. The U.S., even at the height of its global power and global hegemony, isn't able to resolve every human rights issue in every country in the world. And places like Myanmar and Ethiopia are not necessarily countries where the U.S. is likely to intervene militarily, to really put its capital on the line to resolve human rights issues. Hong Kong is obviously a difficult one as well because, you know, it's really the purview of China, which is the US's strongest competitor and rival and adversary. Having said that, the Biden administration is committed to promoting human rights and promoting democracy far more so than the Trump administration. The real question is, do they have the will and the desire to do more than issue concerned statements and, you know, work some back channels and make the US's view clear? They can add sanctions to that, and they've shown some indication that they're willing to do that. But ultimately, when you look at the other things we've discussed today, domestic terrorism and extremism, the COVID pandemic, the economic crisis, all of these things are happening on American soil. Joe Biden is facing as difficult a domestic situation as really any president for 100 years, I would say.
And JJ, we got about a minute. President Biden said that the U.S. is back on the global stage. Are they?
I think the U.S. is still effective and can and will be effective, but it's going to take a minute. It's going to take a while. We're only a month after the previous administration that you mentioned had a very different approach. So it's going to take a minute, but it can happen.
Well, you both handled a very difficult question in an incredibly short period of time. Kudos to you. Thank you. That is all the time we have. Thanks to our panelists, J.J. Green, national security correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA, and Josh Glancy, Washington bureau chief for the Sunday Times. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.
From VOA, Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Ian Kelly, assistant producer in our current affairs unit and a senior at the University of Wisconsin, majoring in political science. Our topic, whither the Republican Party. Our guest, Peter Wehner, a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, and a contributing editor for The Atlantic magazine. The Washington-based Ethics and Public Policy Center, prior to his work at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Mr. Wehner served in several Republican administrations. He worked for Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, and later became Deputy Director of Speechwriting for President George W. Bush. In 2002, he oversaw the Office of Strategic Initiatives, where he generated policy ideas, reached out to public intellectuals, published op-eds and essays, and provided counsel on a range of domestic and international issues under the Bush administration. He has also served as an advisor to several presidential campaigns. Mr. Wehner, a lifelong Republican, has been critical of Donald J. Trump's takeover of the Grand Old Party, the GOP as it's known. His latest book is entitled The Death of Politics: How to Heal Our Frayed Republic After Trump. We'll talk with Peter Wehner about the future of the Republican Party, which has embraced the controversial views and policies of former President Trump, many of which stand in contrast to the conservative values that have undergirded the Republican Party for decades. And Peter Wehner joins us via Microsoft Teams as we continue to practice social distancing. Peter Wehner, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Carol. Looking forward to the conversation with you and Ian.
Likewise. And I'm delighted, in fact, to welcome my panelist, Ian Kelly.
Thanks, Carol.
So, Peter, first, let me ask you about the Ethics and Public Policy Center. What role do ethics and religion play in the formulation of public policy?
The Ethics and Public Policy Center was founded in the mid-1970s. And in terms of your question, I think ethics should be central to politics. Too often it's not. And I mean by ethics not simply that people who are involved in politics should hold themselves to ethical standards in terms of integrity, but also the idea of justice being at the core of politics. In terms of the role of faith in public life and politics, I think there's a role for it. There has been traditionally in American history. I think, honestly, it's a mixed picture. I think there have been times in which faith has played a vital, essential role in the advancement of the moral good, of the common good. And I think there are times in which faith has been an impediment, but it's there and people of faith are getting involved in politics. In principle, I don't have a problem with that in the least, but I do think it needs to be channeled in a way that's constructive as opposed to destructive.
And Peter, you have been an outspoken critic of former President Trump, warning that if Republicans do not disown him, he will own them. And after this recent CPAC conference, the Conservative Political Action Conference, where former President Trump recently spoke, one can safely say that it is Trump's party. You have served in many Republican administrations. What happened, in your view, to this center-right political party, once known for fiscal discipline, lean government, the values of free trade and democracy? How did it become the party of Trump?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a complicated answer. I'd say several things happened, because I think the way to understand this is not that Donald Trump hijacked the party. I think the party had certain trends and currents that were in motion that gave an opening for someone like Donald Trump. He saw it and he took advantage of it. You know, from my own perspective, as you said in the introduction, I have been a lifelong Republican and worked in three Republican administrations. I would identify several things that were in motion probably for the last 10, 15 years on the American right and for the Republican Party. One is that there was a increasing devaluation of ideas, of intellect. I think the party became almost proudly anti-intellectual in its attitude. And it really shifted from, I would say, a conservative understanding of the world, a conservative philosophy, to more of a populist one. And in many ways, populism is antithetical to conservatism. Conservatives are very proud of the pedigree of the conservative movement ideas. That, I think, is really flipped. Secondly, the American right being consumed, I think, by resentments and grievances, cultural and otherwise, that turned out to catalyze a whole series of, I think, dangerous emotions. Fear, I think, is a very big factor on the American right. You know, I have a lot of friends who are Republicans, Trump supporters. I'm in touch with them a lot. And the thing that I've heard consistently over the last 5 years or so is almost an existential fear of what will happen if Democrats and the left take over. Then I would say that you've got the fracturing of information sources. This is a broader, I think, challenge for American democracy, but confirmation bias and motivated reasoning, to use terms that social scientists use, which always exists in human beings, now has a way to be reinforced in ways it never has before because of social media. And then a kind of detachment from reality, drifting off into sort of a different epistemic universe where common facts don't exist. And fortunately, I think a lot of people in the American right have helped lead that. All of those things, I think, came together. Think of them as tributaries that formed a roiling river. And then Donald Trump stepped into it. And so he was a manifestation of those things. But of course, because of Trump and his personality, and by virtue of the fact that he was president, he accelerated what I think are all the worst tendencies that we're seeing.
I'd like to give my colleague Ian Kelly a chance to jump in. Ian, do you have a question?
Yes, thanks, Carol. Last weekend, polls were conducted on attendees at CPAC. While 95% of attendees want the GOP to keep pushing Trump's agenda, only 68% want him to run for president again in 2024. What do you think these numbers suggest about the future of the GOP?
It's a good question, Ian. I'd say it's several things. I think that the fact that there was a big difference in the number of people who support Trump or want him to be a factor in the Republican Party and who want him to run, or an even lower percentage, 55%, said that they would support him to be president. It's not shocking to me. I think the way to understand Trump in terms of his hardcore supporters, and that's really what the CPAC conference was, is that they have unbelievable loyalty and appreciation to him for what they think he's done for them. They believe that he's fought on their behalf, that he has all the right enemies, that he's under attack. And so I think it's almost impossible to overstate the depth of fealty that they have to him. At the same time, I think for some number of even Trump supporters, there's a weariness of the last 4 years. It was just a grinding period in American politics. So much antipathy, so much acrimony, so much conflict. And I think on top of that, Trump lost. The Republicans are now a minority in the Senate and the House. And there's a sense that maybe Donald Trump had his day and it's time to move to a new chapter. Now, having said that, there's no question, as Carol said, it is Donald Trump's party. There's just no doubt about that. The question is how long that will last, how, in my view, the important thing to do is to figure out how to break the Republican Party from the vice grip that Trump has had and what replaces it. But it's not shocking. I mean, we're only 6-8 weeks since Trump left the presidency, so there are going to be residual ties to him. And of course, there's wild cards out there, too. I wouldn't be at all surprised if Donald Trump is indicted for financial crimes that he may have committed over the years. So, you know, it's a step-by-step process. But right now, it's Trump's party, and that's not a surprise to me. That was one of my warnings before he became president, which is, I said, banging the pots and pans. He's going to redefine the Republican Party in a way that's going to hurt it. It's going to hurt the country. And I think that's been validated.
I'd like to follow up on that, Carol. Political scientists credit President Ronald Reagan with transforming the Republican Party when it was divided between moderates and conservatives. Following his presidency, Reagan's conservative ideals left a lasting legacy that is still present in the party. As the GOP is currently divided today, do you think that Trumpism is going to leave a lasting legacy on the Republican Party in a similar way that Reagan did, or do you believe that it will fade?
I really don't know, Ian. I think it's very much of an open question. Trump's imprint on the Republican Party is quite deep. I don't think that that imprint is going to be primarily in the realm of ideas and policy, which is really where Reagan left his stamp. Reagan was a person who was steeped in conservative ideas. It was actually unusual as a presidential candidate and as a president, which is he was first and foremost a conservative, not a Republican. And so he brought a series of philosophical propositions to the job. Donald Trump is the exact opposite. Donald Trump has no philosophical beliefs. I don't think he's opened a book. I can virtually guarantee he hasn't opened a book on political philosophy in his life. And he showed this unbelievable ignorance even during his presidency on an issue. So I don't think the effect is going to be there, though there's some impact. And I would say the Republican Party is more isolationist, more nativist, and more protectionist under Trump than it was before. I think the real impact that he may have, and this is a real danger, I think, for the Republican Party and the Republic itself, is in the realm of his nonstop assault on truth and reality. The conspiracy theories that he propagated that eventually led to the insurrection on January 6th And the entire set of dispositions and sensibilities and the cast of mind of the Republican Party has been deeply damaged. And my concern is that a lot of people are going to emulate what Donald Trump did. One of the reasons they're going to do it is because what Trump has been and his approach to politics, the savagery of his politics, the lies, the shamelessness, and all of the rest has real currency on the American right for reasons that I touched on and for reasons beyond what I touched on. The American right and the base of the Republican Party is willing to buy what Donald Trump has been selling. The question is whether there are enough voices in the party that can come together to offer counter-narrative, and that the moment shifts, and politics is often about moments shifting, and then people take advantage. Think about the Labour Party in the United Kingdom from the late 70s through the early 90s. It was a very radicalized party. And what happened? Tony Blair rose up and created what he referred to as New Labour, and it became a very, very different, much more centrist party. Bill Clinton did that with the Democratic Party. In 1992, he dubbed himself a New Democrat. The Democrats had lost massively in elections from 72 up until 88. So parties can change, but the party has to be willing to change, A, and B, you have to have people who have the capacity to change it and to rally a counter force. And it's not clear on either of those two questions where the Republican Party is right now.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Peter Wehner, senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, and contributing editor for The Atlantic magazine. And we're discussing the future of the Republican Party. We're using Microsoft Teams as we continue to practice social distancing. I'm Carol Castiel, along with assistant producer for Current Affairs, Ian Kelly. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to one of our most loyal listeners, David Manga from Akwa Ibom State in southern Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Peter Wehner. And Peter, I'd like to follow up with you on what can be done. You know, is there a capacity for the Republican Party to change, to be released in a sense from this vice grip of former President Donald Trump? And let's go back to the insurrection on January 6th, this horrible attack on the U.S. Capitol. There were assorted white supremacists, conspiracy theorists, other anti-government militia groups. So many are being arrested now. And yet, you know, they're not the only people. Obviously, there are others who adhere to the Republican Party values such as it is today. But there are so many, as you said earlier, who are promoting disinformation coming straight from Mr. Trump himself, pushing what we called the big lie, you know, that he actually won the election when he did not. He has not yet disavowed that, which is very dangerous. He did not win. The court said so, the Electoral College and so forth. So this is a dangerous trend. So I was wondering to what extent, you know, the so-called establishment Republicans who Mr. Trump and others in the party vilify, people like Mitt Romney of Utah, Susan Collins of Maine, Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, and of course, Liz Cheney, known as a very staunch conservative who had the guts to speak out and voted for Mr. Trump's impeachment and other senators voted for his conviction in the Senate, saying that he did play a key role in inciting this Capitol insurrection. How can such extremes coexist in the party? And do you think it is destined to splinter?
Well, it has splintered. I mean, there's no question about that. I actually am encouraged by that because for the last 4 years, there hasn't been a splinter. Donald Trump dominated the party with almost no exceptions. I would say Mitt Romney is the one exception. Very few Republican lawmakers were willing to speak up against Trump. There were some people on the outside, writers, public intellectuals, who did. But in terms of people who in elective office, not many did. Larry Hogan, the governor of Maryland, and a few others. So the fact that it's now splintering, I think, is a good thing, because at least there's going to be a fight. The people that you named, Adam Kinzinger, Liz Cheney, and Ben Sasse, I think, is in that category, and some others. We're just going to have to wait and see. Somebody told me a long time ago that in life we're not called to be successful, we're called to be faithful. I'd prefer that both would happen in this case. But I think people just have to be faithful. They have to tell the truth. And that just hasn't happened. Donald Trump has dominated the narrative. This was one of the concerns many of us had, which is if you don't offer a counter narrative, if you don't offer truths to his lies, then they're going to take deep root and it'll take a real effort to get it out. How can that happen if it does happen? Well, the first thing is I do think that leaders have to lead. And unfortunately, the Republican Party adopted a view of what it means to be a representative that I think is not right. And the people I would cite would be James Madison and Edmund Burke and Lincoln himself, who argued that we're a representative republic, we're not a direct democracy, and the people are elected to speak their mind and to give voice to their conscience. And that just hasn't happened. I've had countless conversations with Republicans who know better, but were afraid to speak up against Trump. Now that he's no longer president, hopefully some of them will do it. Not enough have, but maybe more will. So that's one thing. A second thing that I think has to happen is what I think Mitch McConnell intends to happen, which is to intervene in the primary process to try and weed out, filter out some of the more extreme and radical elements. And you have to do that by getting, quite honestly, donors and funders to support sane, rational, authentically conservative candidates. McConnell did this once before with the Tea Party. You may recall that in the 2010s, that the Tea Party was a dominant movement, and it nominated some very extreme figures in the primaries. They won, but they lost general elections that Republicans should have won because they were in red states, and McConnell intervened and said, we're going to have a filter system. So you have to do that. I do think that in terms of the epistemic crisis, these various media platforms, you have to begin to either themselves or through government, you've got to have some rules for the road. This can't be a Wild West show. So, you know, at the end of the day, I would say if a movement is to succeed, you need people, you need policies, and you need a narrative that's not just intellectual, but touches the moral imagination of the public. And that's really what the party needs. There are ideas out there to modernize the Republican Party. We will see if there are leaders who step up, and then people have to be able to tell a story that is more compelling than the story that Trump told. But it's an uphill struggle. Right now, the base of the Republican Party is radicalized and angry and not self-reflective. And that's just the nature of reality right now. But things can change. And I just don't believe in fatalism. We have the capacity as a self-governing republic to shape things by how we act. We just need people to have the courage and the wisdom to step up.
Indeed. So that'll be a test for the likes of the Liz Cheneys, the Adam Kinzingers, the Ben Sasses, Mitt Romneys, to see to what extent their voices can supersede the ones that are promoting some of these conspiracies, xenophobia, and so forth. But for now, it doesn't look like that's happening. They are actually being censored by the state Republican parties. But I'd like to get into another topic that sort of transcends these disturbing characteristics we're seeing seep into the Republican Party as a result of Mr. Trump. There's this question of election integrity. And I think my colleague Ian has an interesting question, because the Republican Party now, you know, it's got a shrinking base, one could say. And we're seeing tactics that look like voter suppression under the guise of election integrity.
In a number of states, GOP lawmakers have proposed various voting restriction laws, like reducing eligibility to vote by mail and prohibiting the use of ballot drop boxes. Some GOP lawmakers say that these restrictions are needed to restore confidence in our elections, but other Republicans are warning that this could brand the GOP as the party of voter suppression ahead of the 2022 midterms. What's your view, Peter?
Well, the first thing I'd say, Ian, is the reason that there is not as much confidence in elections as there should be is because Republicans have been telling lies about the last election. So it's a little much for the people who have perpetrated lies, the big lies it's been called, about the 2020 election, to then say that we have this problem that a lot of people don't have confidence in our elections, and then we're going to put forward solutions to it. So I think that's the first thing that we just have to establish. The reason that there's a lack of confidence is because the Republican Party, not everyone within it, but an awful lot of people within it, starting with Donald Trump, have been perpetrating a lie morning, noon, and night. In terms of these efforts to restrict voting, I mean, I'm not an expert on this issue, but as a general matter, I think that they are proposing a solution to a problem that doesn't exist. I mean, there have been any number of credible independent studies that show that voting fraud is not an issue. And that predates the 2020 election as well. And I think it's one of now the top issues on the Republican Party these days. And certainly based on this recent CPAC conference, you would think that that's the case. And that's deeply troubling. And on some fundamental level, what I worry about is that the Republican Party, some of those who are pushing this narrative of election fraud in order to promote quote unquote reforms that will make voting more difficult, especially more difficult for people who tend to vote Democratic, people of color and others, rather than the party trying to reach out and win back voters, white suburban voters, Hispanics, African-Americans and others, which is traditionally what a party tries to do, which is to reach out to new voters or voters that they've lost. What's happening now is the Republican Party has essentially written those people off, maybe because of the Trump years, and they've so alienated them, so toxified themselves, that they can't win them over. So their strategy may be that we've just got to try and, A, have huge turnout for our voters, the ones that we're committed to, which means an increasing radicalization and radical rhetoric to try and energize that base, and B, to try and restrict voting for people who would vote against us. Again, I'm not an expert on election laws, but from what I have followed, this is really disturbing, and it needs to be fought, and it needs to be named.
Peter Wehner, let's turn now to some of the other base voters for the Republican Party and for Mr. Trump in particular. Evangelicals stood by President Trump, presumably not because they thought he was this paragon of virtue, but he was able to deliver in terms of conservative judges and Supreme Court justices that stood for many of the policies that they defend, anti-abortion, and so forth. What is your sense of where they stand now? Do they continue to support Trumpism, the Trump version of the Republican Party?
Yeah, a lot do. I mean, it's the white evangelical movement. I mean, it's a huge movement, many millions of people. And so, you know, there's subtleties within the movement. I mean, you have some evangelicals, people of the Christian faith like myself, who didn't vote for him. Then you have some people who voted for him because they thought his policies were best for the country, but were generally repulsed by him as an individual. And then you had some group of people who were very enthusiastic about him. And those were people who ran institutions and were often on the air making the case for him. People like Franklin Graham, Robert Jeffress, Eric Metaxas, Jerry Falwell Jr., folks like that. But we know from the data that self-identified evangelicals voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump, at least white evangelicals did. That is a real problem. I should say, Carol, that I never begrudged evangelicals for voting for Trump per se. I understood their argument. I certainly didn't agree with it, which is they believe that the policies he would pursue in the courts and elsewhere would do more to advance the good of the country than his opponents. Where I really blame a lot of evangelicals is that they weren't able, apparently, to do two things at once, which is to say, look, I agree with Donald Trump's court appointments, but his lawlessness, the savagery of his politics and the lies are really wrong. And so they didn't speak truth to power. And I think many of them, not all of them, really became seduced by power and ultimately corrupted by it. The other thing I would say, back to something I had said earlier, which I think is important here, Carol, is to understand that disposition of a number of evangelicals, a lot of evangelicals in America, is this fear that I was referring to. They feel like they're under siege. The culture has shifted dramatically on a whole array of issues that's, for them, complicating and problematic, including sexual ethics, but not only there. They feel like the Democratic Party has become more radicalized. They're worried that some Christian institutions may be shut down if they don't abide by certain cultural views on human sexuality. But that kind of fear catalyzed a whole series of dangerous, I think, responses. And the other thing is, the way I would describe the attitude of a lot of evangelicals when it came to Trump is that they thought he would bring a gun to a cultural and political knife fight. And that thrilled them. To simplify what they said, it was something to the effect of, look, people like John McCain, Mitt Romney, and George W. Bush were people of greater moral integrity than Donald Trump, but they were too genteel. They didn't understand the stakes. They weren't willing to fight the way that the left needed to be fought. And Trump was willing to do that. And that sort of thrilled them. And that created this bond. But for me, as a person of the Christian faith, this has been the most personally painful thing of the Trump era, because I think it's difficult to overstate how much damage has been done to the Christian witness, particularly for the younger generation, Gen Z, and to some extent the millennial generation, because they've seen this moral freak show. They've seen these people who, on the one hand, pronounce their Christian faith and insist that they're followers of Jesus, and then they embrace so enthusiastically this man with a kind of Nietzschean ethic, might makes right ethic. and to do it with such relish. And they see it and they just see the hypocrisy of it. And they say, look, I don't want anything to do with this. And I understand that reaction. So this has been damaging. And I think really what's happened for a lot of people, the Christian faith, is something that should not happen, which is that politics became the prism through which they interpreted faith rather than their faith becoming the prism through which they should interpret politics. And the way that they describe the intersection of faith with politics, I think, is really distorted. I think a proper biblical ethic has to do with helping the stranger and the sojourner and the dispossessed and the people living in the shadows of society, and believes in human dignity and human flourishing. Now, the practical prudential application of those principles is, of course, open to debate. But just in terms of the principles themselves, the ethic itself, I think that that's been lost, and that's been a real shame.
And Peter, as we conclude, I'd like you to comment on a recent op-ed. And I think many would like to know, conservatives are longing for a responsible political home, and no question that healthy conservative parties are vital to the survival of democracy. So what do you think can be done to salvage the Republican Party? And as your recent book says, you know, how do we heal the frayed republic after Trump?
Yeah, in terms of revivifying the Republican Party and making it conservative again, authentically conservative, I do think that there need to be people who can speak in humane and human terms and in moving terms about why that philosophy is the best philosophy when it comes to human flourishing and protecting human dignity, that you have to be able to place that movement in a broader story, the American story, and explain to people why in concrete and practical ways that conservatism has something to offer. People need to just speak the truth. Vaclav Havel, who's a person who has influenced me over the years and wrote a beautiful essay in the late 1970s called The Power of the Powerless. And he talked about what happens when a polity, the citizens of a country, begin to live within a lie versus living in the truth. And he said, you know, at the end, that people had to straighten up their spine, their backbone, and they had to speak out against the manipulations and the lies. Because ultimately, I just don't think people can live satisfied human lives if you live in a lie, if you live in a false reality. And so I think people need to speak up about that, but in ways that would actually touch and move people. In terms of the healing of the republic, I mean, quite honestly, I think having Joe Biden now as president and replacing Donald Trump is a good start. It's, you know, the way I've explained it is we had to dislodge the Bowie knife that was in our civic side. Now, when you dislodge the figurative Bowie knife, that doesn't mean that you automatically heal. There's a lot of work that has to happen after that, but you've got to get rid of that knife. And that's happened. I don't think we fully grasp the harm that's been done by the relentless assault on truth and the brutality of Trump's politics over a five-year period. And I think the country's been somewhat traumatized by that. And often when you've been traumatized, it takes time to process that and to step back and even to fully understand the ramifications of it. The rest of us, there's top-down, which is political leadership, and there's bottom-up, which is what we do in our daily lives and what institutions do to try and not just speak the truth to one another, but to listen to one another and to try and make sure that people who have a different view than we do are heard. Both sides have to feel that there's a trust factor. If that doesn't happen, then the armor goes up, you know, the figurative swords are drawn, and you can't argue people out of those emotions. And then the last thing I would say is that government just has to begin to work again, because when that doesn't happen and when there's real suffering or uncertainty or unsettlement in people's lives, it's disorienting and it creates the kind of conditions that allow lies and conspiracy theories to take root. So I think if politics is practiced properly, we begin to get some big questions right and begin to solve some big problems, that may help as well. But it took us a while to get into this mess. It'll take us some time to get out. But the American story is one of regeneration. And as Barack Obama often says, it's a movement toward a more perfect union, not a perfect union, but a more perfect union. But everybody has to put their shoulder to the wheel and move this thing forward.
Peter Wehner is a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and author of the recently published book, The Death of Politics, How to Heal Our Frayed Republic After Trump. Peter Wehner, thank you so much.
Thanks. I've enjoyed being on. Thanks, Carol. Thanks, Ian.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. Joining me on the program was assistant producer Ian Kelly. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Dr.